from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Judy Campbell, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, earlier this week, U.S. senators approved a deal that vastly increases security along the U.S.-Mexico border. That deal is expected to smooth the way for bipartisan Senate passage of a sweeping immigration bill backed by the White House. We'll discuss what's in the bill with a panel of expert immigration lawyers. They're in San Francisco for a meeting of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, in today for Michael Krasny. There are an estimated 11 million immigrants living in the U.S. illegally. Nearly a quarter, about 2.5 million, are in California. Under the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill that the Senate will likely pass this week, those immigrants will have a path to citizenship. If the bill becomes law, it would usher in the biggest overhaul of U.S. immigration policies in more than a quarter century. It would change the emphasis of legal immigration away from those coming to join their families to those who are coming to work. And it would bring a massive increase in security, doubling the Border Patrol with 20,000 new agents, 18 new surveillance drones, and a total of 700 miles of fences. It's an issue of particular importance to California. A quarter of residents here are foreign-born. Joining us to discuss the bill and what it would change if it passes is a panel of lawyers who deal with immigration daily. They're in San Francisco for the annual meeting of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Crystal Williams is the executive director of the association in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Doug Stump is president-elect of the association and senior attorney at Stump & Associates, a Oklahoma City immigration law firm. Welcome.
Thank you, Judy.
And Mark Vanderhout is a founding – sorry, Vanderhout is a founding partner with Vanderhout, Brigliano, and Nightingale LLP in San Francisco, a member of the Board of Governors of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks for joining.
Happy to be with you.
Crystal Williams, there are big, big changes to our immigration system in this bill, and we're going to get to those. But the question that has to be occupying the three of you and those 4,000 immigration lawyers gathering here in San Francisco for the meeting is, can it happen this time? There are attempts at this bill at immigration reform have failed 7 years ago. The Senate is expected to pass the bill this week, but it faces a tough time in the House. What are you seeing?
Well, as you say, it's almost assured, barring something very odd, that it will pass the Senate this time and will pass by a pretty decent margin, at least in the high 60s, I suppose. The House is a bigger challenge. Being majority Republican and the dynamic of some of what the Republican members of the House are facing in their own districts makes immigration reform kind of a tough vote for many House members. Nevertheless, there is an understanding after the last election that the future of the Republican Party may well ride on what they do about immigration. So there's a split in thinking and a lot of soul searching going on in the House right now. It's going to be difficult, but it's not impossible to see something come out of the House and to see something emerge from a conference between the House and the Senate that would be probably to all parties a swallow hard and accept, but that's the nature of compromise.
Well, and there's already been a little of that.
Yeah.
What we saw earlier this week is a beefing up of the security provisions.
Mm-hmm. That's right. An amendment that isn't technically passed yet, but probably will pass within the next few minutes, actually, would add a fair amount of security expenditures to the system and would build it up over a course of 10 years. There's a few other provisions in there. And for everybody, it's a tough one to swallow. As a taxpayer, I find it a little tough to swallow because I'm not sure those expenditures are really needed, and I'm not sure that they advance security as much as they're being sold as. But that's the nature of compromise, and if that's what it takes to get it done, that's what it takes to get it done.
And how does it seem to be working? In the Senate, it has brought more support.
It has brought probably at least a half dozen Republicans who would not have gotten on the bill otherwise.
Now, what's at stake here? What would it mean to not pass reform? Doug Stump?
Well, I think we have to pass reform this time because when you look at where this country is going right now, it's just not possible to remove 11 million undocumented aliens from the United States. And when you look at the business immigration side, currently 2/3 of all engineering students in this country are foreign nationals. So U.S. workers are not able to capitalize on those talents because they're being forced to return abroad, work for other employers.
So I think America is training people who we are not able to
absolutely.
Use.
So there's a balance now of doing something for the 11 million and also doing something to further development and pull this country's economy back out of the doldrums.
Now, you are a Republican.
Yes, I am.
And you are in favor of this bill, and you like the security provisions?
Yes, I do. It took me a while to get on board with this bill. I think, like many Republicans, we believe that, the country has an absolute responsibility and inherent obligation to protect our borders. And that's been one of the drawbacks in the past in trying to pass reform. We saw that if we did something like happened in the 80s, if we do have some type of mass legalization, what would keep those numbers from once again crossing the border? And so I think we had to prove to those individuals that we were sincere in making this the last time. We will never be faced once again with 11 million undocumented aliens in this country. Why? Because the borders will be there and they'll be enforced.
But for many conservatives, it is not enough. You are hearing many Republicans in the House saying that we need a guarantee that we should have a trigger so none of this would go into effect until the borders are secure enough.
Well, I think when you look back at what the Republican Party has asked for in the past, we've given it to them. They wanted assurances that there would be increased border security. We've given it to them. They wanted to be certain that the legalized 11 million would not be eligible immediately for federal benefits. We've given it to them. They want to make certain that this would not cause a huge increase in chain migration. So the system set up that these individuals will be in an RPI status for 10 years, another 5 years before they can become citizens. So we've taken away the opportunity for chain migration. We've given them everything that they asked for. We've made sacrifices, and now it's time for them to make a few.
Well, as Crystal Williams says, there may be more sacrifices to come, it sounds like. And I guess there's always a question of when does this become a bill that it's a balance of being a bill that you support or one that you feel you've given too much away. Mark Vanderhout, could you weigh in on that?
Yes, certainly, Judy. I think this is a delicate balance, and I think there will become a tipping point where, or could, not will, hopefully it won't, but could become a tipping point where the bill just becomes unpalatable for those who are favoring doing something about the 11 million who are here, doing something about our really messed up immigration system where if you're married to a permanent resident, you can't immigrate that person. The person has to wait outside the United States for 10 years or more from some countries, which promotes illegal immigration. So the system needs an overhaul. But I am very, very worried that the provisions are going to get worse, and it could become a bill that ultimately is not supportable. Hopefully that won't happen, but it is a danger. I think the provision that Crystal and Doug both mentioned, and you asked about, Judy, the provisions on the border enforcement. I disagree with Doug, actually, on that. And I think that the provisions that passed this week in the Senate are really an overkill, are a tremendous waste of money, and that's not where we should be putting our resource at this point in time. But as Doug said, and as Crystal implied, that had to be done to get some Republican support. I'm also very, very concerned about some of the provisions of the legalization provision, that this is supposed to allow 11 million people to finally come out of the shadows and get legal status. But some of the provisions are very, very, very harsh. And I want to just talk about a couple of those.
I want to get to those. Let me just mention first that have just gotten breaking news that the Senate has passed that. And the Senate has agreed to spend tens of billions of dollars on a dramatic increase of in border security. So that is now part of this equation. Path to citizenship, let's discuss. This is one of the bigger, one of the biggest sticking points for Republicans. And it has, Mark Vanderhout, you can, why don't you start off by sort of explaining what the path to citizenship is? Maybe path is misleading. It might be more of a long road to citizenship, right? It's at least 13 years before you're going to, someone would be naturalized. But explain how it works first, and then you can tell me some of your.
Well, I think it's the appropriately of long and winding, and the question is there really an end there? The provision is set up so that people can apply. They're in this provisional status for 6 years. And then they can apply again, but the for permanent status. But the problem is the Senate bill, the way it has in it right now, a provision that requires all pending petitions at the time the bill is signed to be approved and visas be made available for everybody in line. That could take 10, 20, 30 years. It might never happen even because some cases are very, very problematic. And if they really mean the literal language of the statute. Every petition pending on that day has to be adjudicated and a visa made available. Some cases take 10, 20 years to happen in complicated cases. If there's two cases out there that aren't approved, is that going to hold up everybody? We have to see what the regulations say and how the statute is interpreted, but that is a very, very troubling provision. The other provision, which I think hoping against hope that this will get changed, is a continuous employment provision. If a worker is unemployed for more than 60 days, they don't qualify to renew their status or get permanent resident status unless they can show it's an extreme hardship upon them.
This is at any point in the process. So someone's been waiting maybe 9 years, they're unemployed.
Correct.
They're off of work.
And it doesn't say if it wasn't your fault. It doesn't talk about layoffs. It doesn't talk about the unemployment rate. It ties workers to possibly discriminating, sexually abusing employers. It's really an anti-worker provision. I think that is one that I really hope will get changed. But, that has to wait and see. And I hope our organization will be pushing hard to get that changed.
Crystal Williams, is that something the organization's working on?
It's one of a number of issues that we would like to see changed. Realistically, I don't think it will be in the bill, but I think that there's a lot of room for interpretation in the administration and execution of the bill. That waiver can encompass a lot of things. So if we can't get it fixed in the legislation, we would be working with whatever administrations down the road are dealing with it to make that waiver really a meaningful and effective one.
Well, let's talk more about path to citizenship. Who are we talking about? We there are an estimated 11 million people living illegally here. Tell us a little more about who that is. What countries are people coming from? Are these people who are here and working? Is the path to citizenship the same for all of them? It's a little different in certain areas, right?
There's actually three different paths in the bill. One is, I will just call it the generic, you're here unauthorized. Either you cross the border illegally or you overstayed a visa and stayed here. So that's one grouping, and that's the majority. There's two other groups, and the other two groups have a somewhat easier and shorter path. There's the dreamers, the people who were brought here when they were children and have been living here as Americans ever since, Americans in everything but the technical fact that they're not, and they're here undocumented. They're referred to as the Dreamers because there has been a bill that has come up time and again called the Dream Act that would help them. They have a five-year path. They have a shorter path. And then there's the agricultural workers. If they could show that they have been working in agriculture, and if they continue to work in agriculture after getting this RPI status for a while, then they can get a green card and go to citizenship in a truncated 5-year period. So those are the main groupings. Nationalities, you know, people say Mexicans, and that's probably the largest single group, but the fact is almost every nationality is represented in this grouping. So it could be any Central Americans, South Americans, Canadians, Europeans, Africans, Asians. Everybody is included, particularly when you consider that it, you know, nearly half the people here illegally overstayed a visa. They did not enter illegally. They overstayed a visa.
Now, I know one part of this bill that is maybe different from last time is that there are more people have come on board. There's agreements with unions, Chamber of Commerce. Is there more consensus around this bill than last time?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more consensus. You know, we see that, you know, how often do unions and the U.S. Chamber come together?
Mm-hmm.
Not very often, but they all recognize that, you know, there are two factors to the bill. One is the 11 million. And the other big faction is employment-based immigration law. And in the past, the those representing or advocating the interest of the 11 million have said that, you know, we are not going to give you any support on employment-based immigration law until you likewise support us. So they always hit a roadblock. But this time they've recognized, they've reached across the aisle, and employment saying, we'll help the undocumented, and the undocumented coalitions are saying, we'll help the employment.
Well, talk about the employment, because there are a lot of changes in this bill for temporary workers, and for those who are applying for green cards. So explain what changes.
Well, you know, right now we have a very flawed system. The H-1B visa category is one that's most commonly used by the IT industry, engineering companies. There's only 65,000 of those visas available a year. You know, the Immigration Service has the fiscal year, and their year begins October 1. The law says that you can file for one of these 6 months early. So on April 1 of this year, all those numbers were already exhausted. There's a huge shortage in professional talent. So this bill would increase the number of H-1B workers who could work in the country. Also, fast track to green cards. If you are trying to get a green card now under the existing category, oftentimes it takes 7, 8, 9 years from the time you start the process until the green card's actually awarded to you. If you are going to be in a STEM field, science, technology, engineering, or mathematic graduate, then there'll be a fast track to green card processing. So it really does. It helps meet the needs of the technology.
Does this sort of get universities involved in the green card business? I mean, you have schools. It kind of changes the relationship.
Absolutely. Everybody teams up together.
Okay. And I know there are concerns about American jobs on the low income. I know Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, has raised concerns that, look, our unemployment is high right now. Wages are low. This is not a time to bring in people to be competing on low wage jobs. Mark Vanderhout?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that is an issue. But I think the reality in our country, and this has been proven over the decades, is that the United States is really dependent culturally, I believe, on workers who will do the tasks that Americans don't want to do. That is the farm work, the dishwashing, the other jobs that perhaps are they consider too menials. We have encouraged. It's really important to recognize that we have had really a policy of allowing people to come to this country undocumented and work in those positions. Americans don't fill those jobs. Now, sure, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders has a point. If companies paid, much higher wages, I think that would change the equation there. So he has a point. But I think the reality is that we need workers to come to the United States to fill, work in the fields, to work in the lower paying jobs. That's just the reality. Now, as Doug mentioned, too, you know, there are many foreigners who come and get university degrees in the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math positions who deserve to stay here. I think you do raise a good question about what the universities are going to be doing and whether those giving degrees, you know, are in the immigration business. There's a question how that will really play out. But I think for the lower paying jobs, for those positions. Our country has been historically dependent on immigrant workers, and the immigrant workers have tremendously contributed to this economy. And I think that's something that gets forgotten in this debate sometimes in the Republican rhetoric, that they're taking jobs and they're destroying our country and they're breaking the laws. We've allowed people to come. We've allowed them to work here and kept them in the status that has kept them in the shadows, and it's time to change that.
Well, then how does this change that industry, say the agriculture industry? I mean, if they've been using undocumented workers at a lower wage, what does this mean for that industry? Are they going to be – these will be legal workers now if this happens, and they will be paid more? Do our prices go up for food?
Well, our prices will go up for food with a legal workforce. Mm-hmm. That is a given. The one thing is, with an illegal workforce, they can't vote with their feet. They can't move to another job. This bill would enable them to move to another job. It does tie them to the agriculture industry for a number of years, but it also controls the wages. What's really different, Doug talked about this earlier, what's really different in this bill is that the agriculture industry and the farm workers have come together and found a common middle ground that they all can live with in terms of the balance of wages and system. What else is different is this bill sets up a procedural framework that isn't so complicated and so burdensome that employers don't want to touch it just because by the time they get the worker here, the crops have already rotted in the field. So that's another big thing. The other part that gets overlooked a lot is the way that immigrant workers actually create jobs. And there's an amazing understanding, at least in the Senate, of that dynamic, not just on the high-skill area, although that's important. A large percentage of high-tech startups are started by immigrants, but also in the lower-wage professions or lower-wage fields. For example, construction. Talking with people in the construction industry, they are telling me that the reason that building startups are down in many areas is because they can't find enough of the base workers, the roofers, the people who do the manual labor to start up. They have enough American workers who do the higher skilled, higher paid elements of construction who are unemployed, not because of competition from foreign workers, but because there aren't enough foreign workers to do the manual work to enable them to do the more artisan work. And so there is that dynamic that we can't lose sight of. The economics of immigration are not zero sum. There is a certain amount of generation of jobs. There's a certain amount of building of the economy. A legal workforce has money, pays for things, buys houses, goes to the store, lives life in the open, and an underground economy becomes irrelevant when the workforce is legal.
And we are on the verge of a break, but let me ask you quickly, do you think this eliminates the underground economy? By the path to legalization, how far will that get us to chipping away at that 11 million? But let's actually hold that. We are discussing immigration reform with members of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, which is meeting in San Francisco this week. Crystal Williams is executive director. Doug Stump is president-elect. And Mark Vanderhout is a member of the Board of Governors. And we would like to take your calls. Please join us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, and today for Michael Krasny, we're discussing the Senate immigration bill with a panel of immigration lawyers who are in San Francisco for the annual meeting of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Joining us is Crystal Williams. She's executive director of the association. Doug Stump is president-elect and also senior attorney at Stump & Associates, a Oklahoma City immigration law firm. And Mark Vanderhout, founding partner of Vanderhout Brigliano and Nightingale in San Francisco, and a member of the Board of Governors of the National Immigration Project. American Immigrant Lawyers Association. And Mark Vanderhout, I wonder if you could take up that issue of, as you mentioned, there are problems that could kick somebody off of the path to citizenship. What are your concerns when that happens? People who would slip through, would life be sort of the same the way it is now, or would it be harder under the system?
Well, I think that's an open question. I think it's possible, and there's been some studies, you know, and people are just, you know, really doing guesstimate to this point in time. But, for instance, the Migration Policy Institute, a very respected institute in Washington, D.C., did a study and estimated that about 3 million of the 11 million individuals who supposedly are going to qualify for this provision under legalization may not qualify because of another provision we haven't talked about yet, which is the income provision. You have to show that you make 125% or more of the federal poverty level guidelines, and their study shows that about 3 million people wouldn't qualify under that provision. If you add in the very restrictive provisions on the continuous employment, which I mentioned before, and the back-of-the-line provisions of all the provisions having to be, all petitions have to be approved, I mean, it could be that we're looking at less than half of the people being able to qualify. So if that happens, and by the way, I still support this bill, so I don't want people to think that I don't support the bill. I do support the bill this time, and I think, as Crystal said and Doug said, it's a compromise. But it may become a point where the balance tips the other direction and that advocates may not ultimately support it if it tips too harshly against the immigrants trying to immigrate or get status or other change in the bill. So to answer your question about what will happen to those people, I think we're going to see a significant number of people still in an undocumented status who won't qualify. And the question will be what will happen with those people. But I think that that's really important for people to understand now, that the provisions for legalization are very, very strict in some aspects and may not result in anywhere near the 11 million being able to ultimately come out of the shadows.
Doug Stump, there's also changes to the country caps at the moment. We have certain countries that China, I think India, Philippines, Mexico, where people are not for green cards, wouldn't be able to get their green, that there's a long waiting list. Other countries, they may sail through, Sweden. That is going to change.
Yeah, and it has to change. Our current employment-based immigration laws are so arcane. No more than 7.2% of all employment-based immigration green cards given away each year can go to a specific country. There is only 140,000 green cards given away each year to all employment-based green card categories. 7.2% limit per country. And when we look at where are all the, you know, brightest minds coming in this day, the IT industry, the science, the researchers, the biomedical researchers, it's China and India. So it oftentimes takes someone from China or India 6, 7, 8 years longer than it would from anyone else, from anywhere else in the world.
So would there be no cap, or there would just be no country cap?
How does that work?
No country cap. So there is a limited number, but they can be distributed among any countries.
Correct. But it also throws out an entirely new employment-based green card system. So it adds additional categories, and so it just opens the door up completely.
And so it changes. Traditionally, we have used family-based connections, that is a priority. Is that right? And it's changing?
And it would keep some family-based, but this is a matter of controversy and, in fact, of concern to us, that it cuts down on some of the family-based categories that people can come in on now. But it does increase employment-based in a couple of ways. One is by adding new categories. The other is excusing some people from the quota. Right now, that 140,000 that Doug talked about includes the family members of those workers. So it really, that represents 2.5 people for every one worker. The family members would no longer count toward the quota, but could come in. But the family base, siblings of U.S. citizens, adult married children of U.S. citizens over age 31, would no longer be eligible for a green card. So it cuts out two major categories of immigration. The first category, the siblings, used a lot by Asian, particularly Asian immigrants, and the second by Latin American immigrants a lot. So that is of some concern.
So do you see – sorry, Mark Vanderhout?
I was just going to add one thing. So listeners who do have family members in those situations or no family members, they're – you know, people are now advising them to get those petitions on file for the, you know, the U.S. citizen brothers and sisters who are petitioning for their siblings, or the for the individuals who would be over, who would be eliminated by being over 31 in the what is now the third family preference category. For those people are being encouraged to get petitions on file. So that's just a tip.
Okay. They'd be grandfathered in.
Okay.
And under the Senate bill, as of date of enactment, we don't know what the House bill would look like, but it wouldn't surprise me if the House bill said as of date of introduction of the bill.
Well, I wonder, do you think we're going to see a major, to say this passes 20, 30 years from now, is the face of immigration going to be different in this country? Are the people who are coming here different, maybe in the countries they're from, ethnicity, the kind of work they're doing, than the people who are coming here now?
That has been our immigration history. Over a course of a couple of decades, we'll see different groupings coming in. Right now, Latino and Asian immigration is strong. I think that this bill would keep particularly Asian, but also Latino immigration strong. But we don't know what world conditions bring for the future. So, yes, the face will change because that's been our history.
Gabriel in Healdsburg joins us. Gabriel?
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah.
Hi, I was calling because I'm a farmer. I don't want to give too much identifying information because we do, you know, like any farmer, we obviously are going to end up employing some people, whether we want to or not, who do not have legal status here. And I've taken a good look at the bill and the wage controls. I wanted to take issue with the idea that this would make food more expensive because the wage controls that define the wages of workers getting their visas through agricultural work are actually well within what farmers are paying. Those are well within the going rates. And additionally, by creating this kind of framework where we can have a social contract with our workers where they can come out of the shadows, I think it creates stability that will actually bring costs down.
You know, I think the caller makes a wonderful point, a great point, in that, you know, I likewise keep hearing people saying that all these farm workers are being paid substandard wages. I do a lot of agricultural immigration work, represent a lot of farmers across the United States. We pay good salaries. So, I think that there is, you know, a false impression that people aren't being paid good salaries these days.
Well, I think
Mark Vanderhout.
I think, you know, it's all over the map, quite frankly. I mean, the caller obviously is a scrupulous employer, and there's obviously many, many of those, and the United Farm Workers Union and the other unions have organized in the fields and have worked with the growers to improve conditions tremendously over the past several decades. But there's also many, many people in farm worker positions in California and Arizona, I'm sure in Texas too, Doug, where there are unscrupulous employers and they've got a population that is can't leave them and they're being really taken advantage of. So hopefully this will change under this provision now.
You can join our discussion by calling 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or send comment or questions to forum at kqed.org. Gary writes, I have heard that most illegal immigrants originally come here legally and overstayed their visas. How will current legislation and securing the border deal with that matter? Doug Stump?
Well, there are some provisions that would actually provide it would be a criminal offense now if one would overstay their visa.
House proposals.
And so, there are more electronic verification measures, right? Can you describe those?
Yes. This actually is a very controversial measure of the bill, but under the Senate bill, there's a phase-in period of 4 to 5 years where eventually all employers will have to electronically verify the employment eligibility of all new workers. And let me emphasize that all new workers. That's not just people who come in and seem to be from another country. That's everybody. So part of the protection there comes from having to verify electronically through some fairly secure means that everybody being employed is authorized to work in the United States. There's concerns surrounding it, first of all, because it is a cumbersome process. Small employers who don't have human resources departments are going to have some problems with it. And that also means that if you hire a nanny, guess what you have to do? Verify his or her employment eligibility. But that being said, that is probably the strongest piece in the whole legislation in terms of stopping the magnet of unlawful employment.
I am at, how close are we to get to getting something like that up? It seems like a massive.
Well, there is a system right now. And certain employers are required to use it now. Others use it voluntarily. It has about, I think, about a 1.7% error rate, or which doesn't sound like much until you start multiplying it by the number of workers all over the United States. But nevertheless, there is a system that exists now, and we have seen that system improving over the years. So, you know, yeah, it exists. It can happen.
John, join us from Walnut Creek.
Absolutely. And just on the tail end of that, I'd also refer to take a look at how successful Secure Communities has been if you want to see what the government can really do with messing up the database. I don't share the interpretation that it's something that's going to be improving, as you can clearly see from the NSA. The government has different issues with databases. But nonetheless, I was a former recruiter for Silicon Valley for several years. And I got to say, one of the main concerns I have with the bill is our problem as a nation. We have a jobs problem right now, and this bill is standing in that way, in a very real way. And an observation I'd like to posit is simply that when I would be working, I worked with huge companies. I mean, talking on the level of Google and above, I can't really go into proprietary who it was, but big companies where I'm looking at people that needed PhDs or above simply to qualify for senior coding positions. And by and large, the legal fees that they would pay for H-1N1B visas to underpay those workers when they would get in those positions in a form of indentured servitude is a real concern. And it does depress wages for the entire industry. This bill does not address that. Silicon Valley said more, not a better process for those legal workers, which deserve a fair shake.
I have to argue with that. This bill does not address that. This bill actually does quite the opposite. What it does is puts in place a formulation for H-1Bs and for green cards that says that if you hire somebody under an H-1B, and actually the way it reads by extension a green card, that you actually have to pay the foreign worker more than you pay the U.S. worker, for the comparable U.S. worker, in some instances considerably more. So the bill addresses that and almost really addresses it in something of an overkill situation.
So is that something there's been Silicon Valley support for this or way
there is reluctant support for the overall bill. That provision is very troubling throughout Silicon Valley because of what it does, particularly from the big companies. They're concerned because they can't be in a position where they pay somebody more just because they're foreign. And so they would have to redo their wage systems. From the small businesses, they simply are put out of the market.
VJ from Mountain View.
Hi.
Question about
my name is VJ. I'm calling from Mountain View. I just wanted to also emphasize that it's not only the tech companies that hire H-1 visas. Like, for my example, I have, you know, a small business that has created 250 jobs, and I need some specialized one or two people every year or every second year. And, for example, I apply for the chefs from India. Those are qualified graduates. And often it is rejected based, why do you need a graduate degree to become a chef? And these are very specialized, very specific jobs. You know, how can we find a person in America who's trained in Indian cuisine? So those kind of things, there should be a small portion kept for that. And also, you know, I agree with the lady there. This is not true that H-1 visas people are paid less. There is a guideline for it. So we pay them as whatever the guidelines for U.S. workers. So that is a wrong myth, actually. Otherwise, if this is stopped, you know, then people should be ready to pay much higher prices for food and everything.
Okay. Thanks for your comment, Vijay. Mark Vanderhout?
I think the what Crystal said is correct on the provisions. Now I think they are addressed. There is concern about the wage provision. They were trying to strike a balance there. There are concerns about that. I think there are issues there. But I agree with what Crystal said previously on that issue. I think that I want to go back to the prior call, just a little comment on the and what Crystal said about the e-verify. I am concerned about that being used as the substantive provision, the main provision. Crystal said that the 1.7% may not sound like a lot, but it is a huge number of people who the government may get it wrong, will be denied jobs because of it. The e-verify system is not running up to the level that it should be to be counted on, in my opinion, at this point in time.
We have a listener that says, as a legal immigrant with an advanced degree in computer science from a top U.S. university, I welcome the expedited green card processing for STEM reform bill. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I have been working in the U.S. for over 10 years, paying my taxes and dues and contributing to the economy. But my wife cannot work because she is on a dependent visa. Is there any provision for allowing spouses of H-1B visa holders to work? Also, what's being done about people in my shoes, advanced CS computer science degrees, working for world's biggest tech companies who have their green card applications in the backlog?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And we've recognized for a long time now that many of these bright minds have bright spouses, but yet they are not an opportunity to obtain the H-1B visa or other similarly situated employment authorization. So the legislation does cover that, and it's a much-needed gift to us.
Yeah. So basically spouses can get work authorization under it, although if there's a country that does not reciprocate and allow U.S. spouses to work, the State Department can cut off the work authorizations that way. I will say, too, that the bill helps with this gentleman's problem as well, because it does have a formula to start clearing that backlog. And his situation, in particular with the amendment that just passed, that amendment would basically push him pretty close to the front of the line.
Okay. Chris asks on our website, in light of the $30 billion boondoggle of border security, I now look to the House to defeat this bill. Originally, I was for reform, but I certainly don't appreciate the way it's made. Lord knows this bill was headed for defeat in the House before the $30 billion slush fund was added. It will be interesting to see what wins out, the Republicans' fierce grassroots and Tea Party opposition to immigration reform or their support for massive spending on military law enforcement. Doug Stump, do you want to take...
I don't think that's a fair criticism, because I think we've seen that this border security initiative is something that Democrats, Republicans alike realize is a must. And even though it may be overkill to some extent, in order to get this,
I think it's fair to say there's been a lot of debate about. I mean, there are a lot of people opposed to beefing up the security.
I agree, but I think when you look at what do we want to do? Do we ultimately want to find a way to provide relief to the 11 million, or do we want to continue to be debating this issue for the next 10 years? And to me, I think that one of the core elements is that border security, and to get the relief for the 11 million, I'm willing to give it to them.
Sorry, Mark Vanderhoof.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say difference on it. I think it's a very bitter pill to swallow. As I said previously, I'm still on board with this bill, as the association is. That provision, I don't agree with. I think it was overkill, and I agree with the caller on that part of it. That was overkill. It was something thrown to the Republican right to get them on board. And I think it is overkill, and I think it was unnecessary.
Yeah, I wonder if you could weigh in too on. I guess there's been conversation about the way Republicans in the House are going to play this issue. I mean, I think you mentioned earlier, Crystal Williams, that the Republicans are wanting to attract Latinos, 70% of Latinos voting for Obama. But there's another question, which is that if there is a path to citizenship, which is something many Republicans oppose, then you may be creating a whole lot of new Democratic voters. And that is a reason for Republicans to block this bill. Anything in that for as a Republican, Doug Stone?
Well, I think you want to look at the, you know, the dynamics of the Hispanic voter, because a large percentage of these individuals, you know, the undocumented are Hispanic, and Hispanics are traditionally conservative. They're physically conservative, and they're pro-life. So they, many of their their foundations, you know, align naturally with the Republican Party.
Richard in San Francisco, please join us.
Yeah, good morning. I think the idea that there is this shortage of American workers unable to do these tech jobs is a myth. It's that industry doesn't want to retrain American workers. It's better to get a crop of 20 to 30-year-old Indians into the country to do the work than to retrain somebody who's been doing tech for 20 or 30 years. It's not like we don't have math skills. It's not like we don't understand the technology. It's that it cuts into profit margins to retrain somebody.
Invest in American workers instead of bringing in foreign ones. Mark Vanderhout.
Well, I think, first of all, when my comment earlier was for the, when I said that we do depend on foreign workers and it is important to allow people to take those jobs, I was talking about the lower skilled jobs, not the high skilled jobs. But I do agree with the caller in one aspect. I think that this country could do a lot more for education. Our education system is horrible in this country, and you know we do need to start at the bottom and get our education system better so people are better trained. I think the caller makes a good point in terms of retraining American workers. I think that money should be put into that, and jobs in these science, technology, engineering, and math should be made available to American workers, and you do need to start at kindergarten, and you do need to do the retraining. I think the provision to allow for more visas for the foreign workers in the meantime is important. I do agree with that, but I do agree with the caller that we have to start at kindergarten and really change our education system and really put resources into the poorer communities, our African American communities, our Latino communities. Many minority communities are underserved in education. There's been discrimination, and that still continues. So we need to start at ground one and really pay attention to that in the long run.
Now, have there been discussions? This is something that comes up in this issue: is the idea of if there is not an American available for a job, what is there anything that then you can hire? Is that something that was addressed in conversations around this?
Well, there already are a number of provisions in the law, and the Senate bill increases those provisions about having to hire American workers first, and then if there are not U.S. workers available, qualified and willing, then you can turn to the foreign workers. So there's a good bit in the bill. There's a lot of debate in the weeds about what works and what doesn't. And those 4,000 lawyers who are meeting down the road, they're going to be spending a lot of the next few days talking about those weeds. But the fact is there are a lot of protections already in the law, and the Senate bill would increase those protections. The other thing the Senate bill does is imposes a lot of additional fees on the hiring of foreign workers by employers, and those fees would go to some of the training that the caller was talking about, not just at the K through 12 education level, not just at the college level, but also for older workers to relearn some of the newer technology.
Okay, no. A listener writes here, I heard Senator Dick Durbin state this morning on radio that under this bill, no American worker will ever be replaced by a foreign worker. We had this stipulation in the past, but it was removed by the American Competitiveness in the 21st Century Act, passed in October 2000 and co-sponsored by Kennedy and Feinstein. He's asking if you immigration attorneys can tell him where in the bill is the language that Dick Durbin describes.
I don't know that I can cite the exact provisions, the number, but it is in Title IV of the bill, It's in the 4200s. I think it's probably Section 4205.
Okay,
but if it's not 4205, it's that neighborhood.
Okay. Well, let's take up an issue people around here are talking about a lot today, and that is the Supreme Court decisions on same-sex marriage. The impact of DOMA on on immigrant communities here and in getting benefits? Will DOMA affect the immigration status of the spouses of gay and same-sex couples?
It should. I hope it does. Tomorrow, the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services will be addressing our group, and we're anxious to hear from him as to how that entity is going to be administering this change. But the main change is that if you are married to a U.S. citizen, you, barring being inadmissible for any other some other reason like a criminal history or something, your U.S. citizen spouse is able to petition for you to become a permanent resident of the United States. DOMA has stood in the way of married couples who happen to be of the same sex. What the Supreme Court decision does in the DOMA decision says that if your marriage is legally recognized by the state in which it was entered into, that should be enough for federal law. Immigration is federal law. Do the math.
Okay. Well, we just have minutes left. Let me have Mark Vanderhout weigh in on what do you think is going to happen? Is this a bill that we're going to see? Is it a bill you think if it does pass that will still be one that you will be supporting?
At the present time, yes. I think it depends on what happens in the future and what comes out of the House. And it could be a close call for many of the advocacy community if the bill gets much harsher and some of the positive provisions get weakened. It may become a close call. But I think right now it's a bill that can and should be supported. I am very, very concerned about the militarization of the border, like I mentioned, and some provisions in the legalization provision, which would render probably only half the people eligible. So there's serious drawbacks to it. I think we have to wait and see, and I think the community needs to be vigilant about that. The advocacy community, the immigrant community in particular, really needs to be vigilant and see what comes out of the House before they decide whether to ultimately support this.
Okay, and we're out of time, so just a one-word answer. Is this going to be a law, Doug Stump?
Ask John Boehner.
I can't add anything to that.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for being part of our program. Crystal Williams, Executive Director of the American Immigrant Lawyers Association, Doug Stump, who's President-elect of the organization, and Mark Vanderhout, who is a member of the Board of Governors. Thank you all for being part of our program. I'm Judy Campbell, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.